the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. And today we speak first with investigative journalist Valerie Bauman, talking about the wild world of unregulated sperm donations and unconventional family planning.
And then clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University, Dr. James Doty, will discuss his new book, Mind Magic. It's the neuroscience of manifestation and how it changes everything. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Having a baby is the dream of many people and becomes reality for many outside of what we might think are conventional means. It's all a lot more complex than you might think. Our next guest is investigative journalist Valerie Bauman, who tells her own story of wanting to become a mother and how she goes about it as a single woman. Her new book is called Inconceivable, Super Sperm Donors, Off-the-Grid Insemination, and Unconventional Family Planning. It provides a window into how exactly the world of unregulated sperm donations work. Valerie, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I had no idea until I started reading your book of what is going on out there in the world. And in fact, I mean, let's start with your story, because you are one of those women in the world who decided to have a baby and figure out how to do it by your own means, sort of. I guess I should put that in air quotes.
Yes. You know, I always knew I wanted children. I grew up the oldest of four kids. I have three younger brothers, so I was changing diapers and band-aiding boo-boos from a young age. And was very driven and intense in my career and, you know, not very fortunate in my personal life. And it came to be the summer of 2020 in the middle of the pandemic. I was 38 and I realized, man, if I do the math, if I meet someone immediately, which is not happening in a pandemic, you know, give it at least a year before you get engaged, you know, 6 months to a year to plan a wedding, then when are you going to have kids? I'll be 40. You know, I realized I got to do this now. So I went straight to the sperm banks, as many do. And I think my reporter sense just didn't feel fulfilled with what I could learn. I felt like I could give a child a good life, but I also profoundly felt like some guilt about not giving them a father. And I wanted to give the kid more answers about their other half of their biology than I could get from a sperm bank. So I ended up just Googling sperm donor that you know, and stumbled upon this wild west that I call the world of freelance sperm donations. And it's made up of, you know, websites, dating like apps. So there's like an app called Just a Baby where you kind of like swipe, you know, it's like Tinder for getting knocked up. And then the Facebook groups, which is where I ended up finding a sperm donor who was very wonderful and stuck with me for multiple years and helped me go through IVF eventually. And now I am about 9 months pregnant. So that's a very quick run through of my story.
Well, congratulations. And we're really excited that we got to interview you before you went into labor.
Me too.
But wow, what a story. So basically, you know, what if you're getting a sperm donor by quote unquote conventional means versus doing something, going on an app like Just a Baby?
Right? Yes, Just a Baby.
What are you getting? What are the benefits of either?
Well, the sperm bank, I think, gives a lot of people a warm, fuzzy feeling. You know, it's you're getting sperm that has been, you know, tested and quarantined and fits the FDA criteria. You know, in my research, I found a lot of concerns about sperm banks. One being that they lobby against any limitations on how many children can be born from one donor. Now, most of them will say they put self-imposed limits, but the industry standard is 25 families per 800 800,000 population. That could be hundreds and hundreds of kids. And that's just in the United States. You know, a lot of these sibling pod groups will find, you know, more in Australia and over, you know, Europe. So I had concerns about that. There's also been a lot of, it's very easy to lie to a sperm bank as a donor and give them false information. That said, it is a little bit more secure, especially if, you know, a lot of the women who pursue the freelance sperm route are not responsible. You need to do a lot of vetting. You need to demand STI testing. I believe it's very important to do genetic carrier testing, even if you find a donor online. And sperm analysis doesn't hurt. A lot of people pass on that test when a donor has produced multiple children because they figure he's not firing blanks, but it can't hurt. The upside to the freelance sperm route is price. First of all, you're saving a lot of money. And with frozen sperm, it only lives in a woman's body up to 24 hours. Whereas if you use a known sperm donor, getting fresh sperm, you can get multiple donations per cycle. So I would typically get 3 donations per cycle of fresh sperm, which lives in the body up to 5 days. So that can kind of increase the odds of success. And it doesn't have a price tag on it for the most part. Now, a lot of recipients will pay for travel costs for a donor, you know, reimburse them for gas or things like that. But most of the guys do it for free. The good thing about using a sperm bank is you don't encounter men who are creeps who are going to try and coerce you into sex, which does happen. It's a big problem in the world. And if you're going to go the freelance sperm route, you need to take a lot of precautions and come up with very good screening tools to make sure that you are not getting a sexual predator or a psychologically damaged person, or, you know, just somebody with bad genes who, you know, could pass on a disease or disorder that can cause chronic problems for your future child.
That's so interesting. The first inkling that I ever had that this kind of process even could exist was back when Melissa Etheridge and her partner Julie Cypher had David Crosby on the cover of Rolling Stone, and it was entitled The New American Family, or Making the New American Family, something like that. That was almost 25 years ago, if you can believe it. How far do you feel we've come as a culture or not since that story was such a big deal?
Well, that time, I think in the 70s and the 80s, lesbian couples really pioneered this kind of freelance sperm world. A lot of them found gay men or friends, like the Crosby situation, to help them have children. The real kind of birthplace of the freelance sperm world was in those early 2000s when you saw Yahoo groups and Craigslist, where, you know, men started popping up posting their sperm was available, or women would pop up saying they were, you know, desperately seeking sperm donor. And it was just kind of the nascent, you know, emerging scene at the time, but I've talked to multiple donors and that's how it started for them. And now there's these greater platforms that are making it easier to connect the recipients with the donors. But I think that it's happening at such a pace that a lot of people are just trying to make babies without thinking of some of the consequences. Now, I am a participant in this world, but I don't condemn it and I don't condone it. I think you need to do it responsibly and make a choice for what's best for you. But I see women posting, I need a sperm donor tomorrow. And it's like, no, that is not enough time to vet the person who's going to be the biological other half of your child. Sperm is not sperm. It is not all created equal. You need to know where this is coming from. This is going to create a human being. And I think it creates a lot of complex bioethical questions. But at the same time, how is the government going to regulate who can have children and how many children you can produce? It's not something that anybody really understands how to place any limitations on.
Sure. And well, you bring up an interesting point with that. It seemed like the big turning point for you was when you Googled how to have a baby or how to get sperm from someone you know. Was there a reason that you didn't reach out to an actual current friend of yours or somebody in your circle already? What made it more preferable to kind of go one circle out from your own group of friends or whatever?
That's a great question. I mean, I started with the sperm donor that you know, the freelance sperm world. But after it didn't work out with one donor, and after interviewing donor conceived people who, you know, they don't ask to be born not knowing where they come from, I wanted to know, I wanted it to be a friend. And I did work with a friend of mine who I've known for, you know, 18 years probably at this point. And he, you know, he is a gay man. He never saw, you know, a clear path for him to have kids on his own, but he agreed to help me. And so, you know, we got started, but we tried a few cycles before his sperm analysis results came back, and it turned out he was infertile, which was just heartbreaking because he would have been such a great option, but it didn't work out for him.
Maybe so I went back because it led you to this journey.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of already in the middle. I worked with a donor for a while that I found on Facebook. And then I went to my friend, David, who I talk about in the book and Inconceivable. And then I went back to that, and that donor, and that's who ultimately helped me become successful. So
thank you. Great. Wow.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with investigative journalist Valerie Baumann. She tells her story of wanting to become a mother, and she's just about to give birth. But in amongst all of this, she's written a book called Inconceivable: Super Sperm Donors, Off-the-Grid Insemination, and Unconventional Family Planning. Okay, so Valerie, a moment ago you were talking about the one friend that you had found out that he was infertile. What is sperm analysis and what does it tell you exactly? How many different factors are they testing for?
There's three main factors. You want to get the sperm count, of course, how many, you know, little guys are in there. And you want to get motility, how active are they? And then morphology, are they deformed in some way, or do they look like the traditional, you know, round head with the tail? You know, you'll get sperm that have, you know, more of a diamond shape, or they have two tails, and so those are less healthy. So those three factors will really tell a reproductive endocrinologist, those are the specialists that work at fertility centers, just how likely a man is to get you pregnant successfully, and what, you know, and the count being the biggest factor, but the other two are also very important, of course.
Yes, that's interesting. And so any sort of genetic analysis is not in that, just in a sperm analysis. So
correct. Yeah, you go, and the genetic carrier screening is something different. And you generally will, you know, you'll have blood drawn by both parties, and then you'll speak with a genetic counselor. They'll give you a report back and let you know what you're a carrier for. And hope, and as long as both parties are not carriers for any one of the same things, your baby will be fine. I'm a carrier for spinal muscular atrophy. No one in my family on either side, going back as far as we can tell, has ever had this. However, I almost worked with a donor at one point who did, you know, have a carrier to, pop on the test for that. So that could have been devastating. It's a disease where sometimes the child dies, you know, before age two. And in any case, it's typically a very limiting disease, very profound disability. So I urge everyone to do genetic carrier screening, even if you think, oh, never in my family. Well, it was never in my family either, but you know, it's, especially as somebody who's going to be a solo mom, you know, there's no child support to get from a sperm donor. I need to be realistic about what I can take on. And so being cautious to get the healthiest baby possible was the route that I thought was most responsible.
You explore the costly and discriminatory world of sperm banks and fertility clinics, which is something I hadn't thought too much about. Are we at risk of becoming a world where only the wealthy and exclusive folks get to have the best babies? Are we already there? Is this something that maybe this is a good workaround?
I think we're already there. And I think it's unfortunate because I see so many women making impulsive and unhealthy decisions about choosing a sperm donor online. And they're directly put in that path by an industry that has priced them out of fertility. And it's really unfortunate. You know, the Supreme Court has ruled that it is an inherent right to be able to have children and give life and reproduce. It is something that humankind, you know, all living creatures have this biological imperative to reproduce. And having personally gone through infertility, it took me, you know, 4 years to get to this point where I'm 9 months pregnant. There is nothing like the heartache of not being able to have a child. Now, there's plenty of people these days who don't want to ever have kids, but I think by and large, it's a very unifying human feature to have that drive to create life. And when you have financial obstacles, I mean, sperm is, you know, probably averaging around $1,200 a pop, not counting shipping costs. If I would have paid probably an extra $30,000 if I had paid for every sperm sample that I got. Plus, when you work with a freelance donor, you get the entire donation. When the sperm banks get the sperm, they can divvy it up 8 to 10 different vials. So you're paying so much for a fraction of an actual donation, which the industry explains by saying, well, of course we need to regulate and have standards so everybody gets the same amount when they purchase it. But it's still seen as a little unfair.
It so. Does. It does. And I was so interested in your desire to communicate and have some presence of your donor, hopefully in your child's life. What kind of vetting or questions did you ask or things did you talk about beforehand? What was most important to you?
I think the number one thing is, what was this donor's motivation? And so many of the donors, they either do it for sex or money. You know, breeding fetishes are a very real part of this world. But I think that a lot of donors that I'm comfortable with, they find themselves with this, it comes back to this biological imperative. You know, maybe they've had two kids and they can't afford any more, but they want to have more and they want to do it in a responsible way. You know, their own family structure can't financially sustain it. And this is a way to help people. A lot of men come to it because a lesbian friend has approached them and they helped that person, and they get to see that kid and the joy that they've created by helping establish a new family, and they get the bug for it. And so those donors are the ones who I'm most comfortable with. Other questions, you know, I think the vetting process is different for everyone. I like to know, you know, what kind of relationship they have with their family. Obviously, mental health history for everyone in their family is a huge, huge question. But also, you got to think protectively, you know, because I worked with an attorney to create a contract with my donor, she made me think of a lot of questions I wouldn't have. Like, for instance, if I was to die, would you want custody of this child? Or let's say you found out later there was some accident and you couldn't have a child of your own. Would you ever challenge me for custody if this was the only living biological child you could create? Wow. These are the things that a lot of women who are just going out into the freelance sperm world aren't even thinking about. And that's why I encourage everybody, talk to a lawyer, pay the money for a lawyer. You're still going to save money in the long run going with a free sperm donor. But protecting the custody of your child and making smart decisions about who you choose, everybody can use a little bit of guidance on that. It's an investment worth making.
Wow. Yeah. The woman who says, I need a sperm donor tomorrow, is not looking at all those at all. And so I imagine that there are attorneys that this is what they specialize in, this sort of thing. Probably something along the line of those who also specialize in adoption and things like that.
Yeah, you would go to, they call it an ART, an assisted reproductive technology attorney. And some of them do work in adoption. A lot of them work in, you know, they'll have like second parent adoption. So if a lesbian couple has a baby via sperm donation, I always strongly encourage the non-gestational mother to adopt the child, protect your custody. There's a horrible case out of Oklahoma where a couple had a private donor and had a child, and at age two, they broke up, and the child was age two, they broke up. The mother moved in with the sperm donor And then an Oklahoma court ended up removing the woman's name from the birth certificate. And because she hadn't done a second parent adoption, the judge said, well, the birth certificate isn't enough just because your name is on the birth certificate. And she stripped the woman's name from the birth certificate, put the biological father's name on the birth certificate. And that is still a fight that is ongoing right now. So you can never be too careful.
Oh, wow. That is quite a story. Okay, I just have to ask you what about a breeding fetish. I saw somewhere in the book that you had or a sperm donor had maybe approached you and was sort of saying, yeah, I have 65 kids around in the world. You know, I would call that a breeding fetish, but what is up with that strange world?
Well, I have to tread carefully because the moderators and admins at these Facebook groups, which I still participate in, I try and advocate for women, give suggestions, reach out to those who are, you know, who need it. The super donors have a stranglehold on these Facebook groups. So I have to be careful what I say to not get myself excommunicated. But I do know for a fact, there's one in particular, Kyle Gordy. He's actually on the current season of 90 Day Fiance, Love in Paradise. And he is a sperm donor. I think he's up to around 80 children now. He is quoted in my book, In Inconceivable, talking about, you know, he's never had a relationship last longer than 2 weeks. He only wants to have sex for procreation. He doesn't really get any joy out of non-procreation sex. You know, I've interviewed him for many, many hours over several years. I'm not a doctor. I can't prescribe, I diagnose somebody with a breeding fetish, but there is a compulsion there that is undeniable. And a lot of women will go with these super donors who produce lots of children because they just want a sure thing. They're like, oh, he's gotten 80 women pregnant, I'll be next. But what you need to think about, and the entire reason I went this path, is you've got to put the kid you're producing first. You may not think they need to know where they come from. You may not think that they are going to want to know who the sperm donor is that helped create them, or that they're going to want to know the 80 other siblings out there. But think about all the ways that you didn't turn out the way your parents expected you to turn out. You can't place bets on your child's personality and desires. So give them every opportunity that you can while you have control over it, to make the decision for themselves where they're going to end up in terms of meeting or having relationships with their biological connection. So I hope that answers your question.
For anybody out there who's thinking about exploring freelance sperm donation, what kind of advice or guidance would you offer them as they approach the journey?
Well, shameless plug. I think my book has a lot of advice. I think it's really a great handbook for kind of how to avoid pitfalls.
And it is very entertaining as well.
Well, thank you. I hope so. It was a wild ride. But I think, you know, number one, take your time. You know, do not rush this process. I think that a lot of, I have had moments of desperation and certainly a sense of urgency, I'm now 42 and I'm finally pregnant. It's taken me 4 years to get here. But again, not all sperm is created equal. Take your time, vet your donor, get all the testing done that you possibly can, get to know them, video chat with them, meet them in person, establish a relationship, make sure you can stay in touch. Even if you don't think you're ever going to want to see them again, what if your child develops what would appear to be a genetic condition? Don't you want to be able to reach out to them and say, hey, have any other siblings developed this? What kind of treatment options are out there? Has anybody else in your family had this? Stop donating because this disease is serious. There's so much that can require you to go back and track that donor down and can, you know, stay in touch for reasonable purposes. I would also say spend some time doing research on the perspectives of donor-conceived people. If you're going to create a child from donor conception, think about how it's going to make your child feel. So often, donor-conceived people are told, you should just be grateful for being born. You wouldn't be here if it wasn't for this. Well, that's really invalidating of their feelings when they feel that they've been lied to, or even if, you know, they haven't been lied to, but they've just been denied to know this. I mean, in my book, I interview a mother and daughter, and, you know, the mother just thought, of course, I'm going to have a mini me. Well, the kid was nothing like her mother. She was a, you know, a carbon copy of the sperm donor, and the sperm donor was supposed to be anonymous. The daughter ended up tracking down the sperm donor, and now they have a good relationship of sorts. It's not like a father-daughter relationship, but filling that void of the unknown and getting answers on where she comes from, because she was so unlike her mother, was huge for her mental health and her emotional health and her relationship with her mom. They were having a very strained relationship for many years because of this unknown anonymous sperm donation scenario. Now they're on wonderful terms and they understand and love each other with a new depth. And I think that's so important. You need to give your children permission. I think too often parents of donor conceived people don't realize your children will protect you. They'll say, oh no, mom, I don't need to meet the sperm donor. I don't care. You're good enough for me. And they're just trying to protect you when their little hearts are breaking inside. And that would kill me. I don't want my kid to ever feel they can't be honest with me. I am mentally preparing myself for the fact that I built in some heartbreak to my kid's reality by not giving them an active father. And I've done my best to make room and get for that reality and prepare myself to hold space for their feelings.
That's so smart.
Really just putting the kids first.
Well, what an interesting story. The book is called Inconceivable: Super Sperm Donors, Off-the-Grid Insemination, and Unconventional Family Planning. Our guest is investigative journalist Valerie Baumann. And Valerie, thanks for this really interesting conversation and best of luck with your upcoming birth of your baby.
Thank you. It's an exciting time. It's a big year, book and a baby.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Dr. James Doty is a clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University and founder and director at the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford. He's the author of the best-selling memoir, self-help book, one that I loved very much, called Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain. And now he's back with a new book called Mind Magic, The Neuroscience of Manifestation and How It Changes Everything. For decades, the practice of manifestation has been widely dismissed as self-involved, materialistic pseudoscience. But listen to Dr. Doty, who joins us to explain how new neuroscientific research proves how manifestation physically alters our brains, brings our dreams to fruition, and lays the groundwork for a better world. Dr. James Doty, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. You can see I sort of look like I'm in the mountains, and I have my hoodie on, so I'm all set here.
Thanks for being in the mountain spirit, Dr. Doty.
Absolutely. I love the mountains.
Many of the people, my age at least, remember the big burst of manifestation onto the scene years ago with The Secret, right? This book, this movie, and everybody started making vision boards and they're visualizing their parking spaces. But manifestation is much bigger than that, and it's come a long way in our understanding. Can you share a little bit about the evolution of what manifesting is?
Sure. In its simplest form, this is one having a desire and it occurring. And then it occurs, theoretically, by utilizing certain techniques that historically have been associated, if you want to use the term, with woo-woo or pseudoscience. And as we know, oftentimes there's a kernel of truth in some of the statements, but people add to it, and then that's where there are problems, or they misinterpret it. And I think The Secret, unfortunately, did a huge disservice to so many people. One, it promoted this narrative of something called the law of attraction, which you can track back actually to the first and second century. But it's this narrative that there is something out in the universe and it listens to you. And if you put out positive energy, it will reward you with what you want. Now, unfortunately, what happens sometimes with that is that if it doesn't happen, there's a whole it's your fault narrative that goes with that, which many people suffered from. I think the other problem was, and this is unfortunate in Western capitalist society, there's a narrative that has been promoted that success translates into money, power, position. And As a result, many people are focused on that with the belief that if that just happens to them, if they're quote unquote successful, all their problems are solved and they're going to be happy. And this is really what The Secret promoted. Unfortunately, that type of a narrative is from the lens of selfishness, in some ways narcissism, and it separates you actually. And it results in you looking through the lens of scarcity. I want, I need, I have to have. And the problem with that is that when it's all about you, actually it shifts you away from what we would call our rest and digest system, which is part of our nervous system, our autonomic nervous system, which has two parts, the parasympathetic nervous system, which is where we should live most of the time, and our sympathetic nervous system. And I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with the sympathetic nervous system, which is the flight, fight, or fear response. And when you engage that system, parts of your brain, in fact, most of your brain doesn't work as well, except the part associated with survival. And I'll explain that to you in the sense that we, in terms of our DNA, is not significantly changed from how it was 200,000 years ago on the savannah in Africa. If a predator approached, let's say you saw the grass move, your sympathetic system would kick in and all the associated effects from that. It shuts down certain parts of your brain so that you don't spend a lot of time discerning what is right or wrong or what is appropriate. You pick the shortest path to survive. And it also has peripheral physiologic effects. Your heart rate goes up because of the release of epinephrine and norepinephrine. Your stress hormones increase. Your blood is shifted from your abdominal tract, your gastrointestinal tract, your skeletal muscles, your pupils dilate, et cetera. And this gives you the ability to escape because you're focused on surviving. But the way it's supposed to work is it turns on and then it turns off and you're back to your basic system, engaging the parasympathetic nervous system. And the advantage of that is that in that system, you are open, you're thoughtful, you're more creative, you're more productive because all of your cognitive brain networks are functioning. And that's where we live our best life, if you will.
Right. Several years ago, I wrote a book on creative energy and flow, and I read a lot of research and a lot of books in the process of writing that. And I don't think I read a single one that put together neuroscience and the physiological responses, along with something like manifesting or energetic work. What drew you to combine those things or to relate them to each other?
Well, obviously, as actually I mentioned before we started, I am not religious. Many people would say I'm very spiritual, but I'm interested in the science side of things. And obviously that's my background. And when things don't make sense or actually create a negative narrative when they could be very positive, that's where I have issues. Now, from my first book, Into the Magic Shop, I talked about an experience that I had when I was 12 years old. Part of that related to an individual teaching me a mindfulness practice because I was a lost youth with a lot of despair and hopelessness. But the other thing she taught me was a manifestation practice. Now, she did not combine it with woo-woo, but she used many of the standard techniques associated with it. And one of which, of course, is making a list. And the other is using your senses to reinforce that list. Because as we know, neural pathways are laid down with repetition. And that's why people say what fires together, wires together, and it reinforces those. So by utilizing these techniques of writing things down, reading them silently, reading them aloud, visualizing you in that position, these strengthen neural pathways. The problem, of course, was for me at 12, I had no self-awareness. So things I listed were what are often listed and you could say are what are promoted by The Secret. Mm-hmm. I said I wanted to live in a mansion. I wanted to be a millionaire. I wanted to have a Rolex. I wanted to have a Porsche.
Very ego-driven.
Exactly, and self-serving. Now, I also put in there that I wanted to be a doctor because I had been so inspired by somebody who came to my fourth grade class on Professions Day. And I got all of those things. In fact, beyond that, the problem was that what I thought success was ended up being quite empty. Here, I would climb a mountain, metaphorically speaking, and then wait for the sudden feeling that I was whole and okay, and my shame was taken away and my insecurity. And the problem was that it was all about me. And the other problem was that I thought external affirmation would make me whole and feel good. Having accomplished all of those things, I was more unhappy than I had ever been in my life. And I went through this period of reflection to understand what went wrong. Because I had no self-awareness or insight, I thought it was all about me. And if I got all these things, then I would be whole. Went through this period of reflection and I sort of got it. But what it did was I set up health clinics around the world, programs for the disabled, programs for adolescents with AIDS, HIV, and scholarships and other things. And what I tell people is I went from rags to riches on some level. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to rags. But the next step was I did get riches again, but they weren't monetary riches. You know, I became, I founded the center at Stanford. I became friends with the Dalai Lama. I became chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation. I met all these incredible spiritual and religious individuals around the world. And that so enriched my life. And it was a realization that all of these practices fundamentally relate to compassion and being of service. And that's what makes you whole. That's what creates a life of meaning and purpose. And that's also when you are in that mode, which is the parasympathetic nervous system engagement, then that's when your brain functions best. And actually, it is in that mode how you best manifest.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Dr. James Doty. He has written a new book. I guess it's sort of a follow-up to Into the Magic Shop. And we spoke with you when you came out with that book. I'll never forget the story of you going into the proverbial magic shop, or the literal magic shop, actually. His new book is Mind Magic. It's the neuroscience of manifestation and how it changes everything. So, Dr. Doty, you figured out that, you know, there was this manifestation, but it was hollow. And through compassion is what you've figured out is how to have a more rounded, full manifestation. But I'm also very interested in the neuroscience. And as a, you know, neurosurgeon, you know, we're being able to tie the woo-woo to science now. I'm wondering the beginnings of that, where that started, because it seems like in about the last 15 years or so, we've been talking about the heightened plasticity of the brain and how you can fundamentally change who you are. Was it sort of the onset of the fMRI machine, the functional MRI? Is that how you can actually chart these things going on in your brain?
Well, actually, there are several ways to do it. And this spans actually even before fMRI with use of electroencephalography or EEGs. But now we have a variety of tools, the two I just mentioned, as well as self-report and also obtaining of samples of saliva and blood where we can measure certain chemicals that are associated with different mental states. And so over the last many years, we've gained much more knowledge. And one area of knowledge is what we call cognitive brain networks. How do they interact? And as I mentioned a little bit earlier about how the sympathetic nervous system can have a very negative effects, at least in the long term, if you look at how the brain functions in the context of engagement of the parasympathetic nervous system, it actually engages at its best. Now, let me just back up and say that one of the challenges, you know, when people want to manifest is one, I would say everyone is always manifesting. It's just most people do it very inefficiently because they've never been trained. It's like doing any type of exercise. If you're new to it, it takes practice and it takes work and it takes showing up. The other aspect is that you also have to understand what you've already been manifesting. as both of you know, and many of our listeners know, either from self-awareness or experience, your childhood and the baggage you've carried from that oftentimes has a profound effect on how you function in the world, whether in regard to conversations with others, the partner you pick. And until you have some insight into that, it's hard to change, because what you've laid down through your development are neural pathways. And if somebody, says, geez, I don't understand what happened here. I've married three individuals who are all alcoholics and abusive. I don't get it. Well, you have to go back and figure out what brought you to that point, because you have manifested that. So one thing is to have some insight. The other is to appreciate that many people give their self-agency away. Our brain is extraordinarily powerful, and they give that self-agency away, as an example, by saying, please, universe, change my life and make everything better. And that's the wrong way to manifest, because there is no external omniscient thing out there that is going to change everything about your life. The most powerful thing to change your life is your mind. I'm sure you're familiar with the term negativity bias, or this idea of chronic negative self-talk. Well, if you tell yourself, it is not possible, I don't deserve, I am not worthy, that becomes truth. And unfortunately, a lot of people listen to others. I'm sure you've been in a situation where you shared with somebody this dream or aspiration of yours, and they'll say to you, you'll never be able to do that. Why waste your time? And the sad thing is, people listen to that. And
especially, it's hard not to.
especially children. And so these things get embedded, but you have a choice.
And I think sometimes people get afraid of that agency. They worry that the kind of morality tales of careful what you wish for are going to come and bite them in the butt. If they, the things that they want to manifest might turn out differently than they expected. So they don't try to manifest anything. So how can we frame things so that we can embrace the power to direct our lives without as much fear or worry?
Well, unfortunately, what has allowed our survival as a species on some level is fear and worry. But what you're mentioning is how you'll talk to some people, let's say somebody in an abusive relationship. Well, I know this demon, I don't know the unknown demon, right? And so I think that does create fear. But what people need to understand is belief is extraordinarily powerful. I just gave the example, if you say it's not possible, that is reality. And if you say it's possible, that makes it much, much more likely to occur. But your mind has to be in the right state. One has to do with understanding how your own thoughts affect your life and affect your physiology and affect every interaction you have. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually quite powerful. And they're fundamental basic techniques to utilize. And they're not woo-woo. Now, the woo-woo side of the house has embraced some of them. And what happens is, over hundreds, if not thousands of years, people experience certain events that they then wrap around a dogma to justify it because of lack of knowledge. And then that dogma can be very powerful. And frankly, people can be manipulated through different ways to that dogma. If you look at it strictly from a science perspective, these cognitive brain networks, which are ill-defined but work together, actually are very powerful. And one of those is something called the default mode network, which is associated with mind wandering or daydreaming. But it's also self-referential, and it's where you paint the picture of yourself and what you want. And all of that is great. But if you are chronically having negative self-talk, then what are you going to manifest? What are you going to put out there? Do it correctly, and you create this narrative that is positive and being of service, then this activates something called your salience network. Because when we have a desire and intention, we have to put it into our subconscious, and that's something called value tagging. It makes it salient. It makes it important to you. Then the salience network results in your attention network focusing on that goal. And then once that happens, then, and if you will, and I think I use the example of a bloodhound, Once you've activated the bloodhound is looking for opportunities to make things manifest. And then if these executive control network, which has experience to prior memories and experiences, that acts as the CEO, if you will, to tell you what to do. And let me give you an example. I'm sure you've been to a party and it's really noisy. Yet if somebody says your name, you immediately turn. Well, why is that? Because your identity is deeply embedded within you. And so your subconscious is always attuned to events where you hear your name. And as another example, as a neurosurgeon, I see patients with, some people would say, unusual conditions. But let's say I had a patient who, as an example, had hydrocephalus. And she goes, I have never heard of that before. But I'll see her 2 months later and she goes, the most amazing things. I've run into five people who have the same thing. I didn't realize I was so common. Because you were attuned to listening for that, right? Yeah. It has now become embedded. And I was just at a coffee shop a few months ago, and there's a project I've been working on that's fairly esoteric, but it was very loud and noisy. Yet among the din of all of that, I heard somebody use terminology associated with that. And I walked over and introduced myself, and we're working together on this project. And it creates synchronicities or coincidences based on your bloodhound always being attuned to possibilities of what will help you manifest. And the challenge is, though, the difference between people getting confused with what we call hedonic happiness versus eudaimonic happiness. And one could argue, I think, that hedonic or hedonistic actions, self-serving actions, such as are promoted in The Secret and other narratives, you may get what you want. The problem is the want and the fulfillment is transitory and it's very shallow. And so let's say you buy something and for a brief period of time, you go, God, this is great. I really like this. And then within 24 hours, you go, oh, it's just another thing. And the problem is this emptiness we have inside of us cannot be filled with that. Mm-hmm. The thing that fills you is to have purpose and meaning. And that translates into being of service, caring about others, and doing actions in that regard. And if your focus or what you wish to manifest are focused outward towards being of service, because that's how we evolved as a species, it is much, much more likely that you will get what you want. Now, you made a statement earlier that says, be careful of what you want. Well, once you start looking through that lens of compassion or caring for others, oftentimes you change what you want.
Right. And this is why your book, Mind Magic, is all about these different steps that you take.
Well, one was what I mentioned was understanding what you're already manifesting. Mm-hmm. Two is to take control of your mind in the sense of learning how to focus. Three is, if you will, clarifying your intention. What is it that you really want after thought and understanding and some degree of self-awareness that we just talked about and also in the book? And then the other is pursuing the goals passionately, which relate to doing the work. You know, a converse statement that I could make is God only helps those who help themselves.
Sweat your prayers.
Yes. And then one of the things that people struggle with is attachment to outcome. The point of this also is not to say, well, you just do everything Jim Doty says and you'll have this perfect life of abundance. Unfortunately, the nature of our humanity is we have ups and downs, we have successes and failures. And the fact that something doesn't work out exactly the way you want or see, or doesn't work out at all, doesn't mean you failed at the practice. There are a variety of other interfering aspects. But what I'm pointing out to you is, how do you use your mind to maximally create the environment for your intentions to manifest? And those are far different from me saying, just do this and everything's going to work out perfect for you. It doesn't work that way. But one of the greatest things, as I mentioned just a little bit ago, is one of the greatest causes of suffering is attachment and craving. And for two reasons. One is you chase this chimera, if you will. And sometimes, unfortunately, people sacrifice everything to get that. And then they're at the top of the mountain and they're by themselves and they've left carnage behind them of children, relationships, and they're standing there alone with nothing. Well, what is that? What is it you really wanted there? I think most people want, you know, there's a quote, and I can't remember from who, but it says, when I die, when my children think of kindness and compassion, they think of me.
I think that's something we could all aspire to.
So that should be your goal, is to inspire others to live lives of purpose and meaning. But it is through those actions that you're most likely to manifest.
Oh, that's wonderful. We've been listening to Dr. James Doty, whose new book, Mind Magic, The Neuroscience of Manifestation and How It Changes Everything, is sure to bring really interesting insights to things that we've all heard a lot about and dabbled with in the last 20 years. It's brand new information, and it really digs deep into the science and the brain and the nervous system and all the things that support maybe the missions that we all set for ourselves. Dr. James Doty, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for sharing this information and for telling us about your book.
Thank you. You guys have a great day and manifest your dreams.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can hear this full episode wherever you get your podcasts, on the KPCW app, or by visiting the Shows tab at kpcw.org. If you like what you hear, leave us a comment, rate us, and be sure to subscribe to stay on top of all of our show episodes. And if you have an idea for a future episode of The Mountain Life, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.